I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Saturday, October 31st, 2015. The time is 10:07 a.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Garrett, Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Gaddis, Edgman, and Munoz. Today, again, is the overview by Pat Pitney on the Trans-Canada proposal. We have Pat Pitney as the Director of Office of Management and Budget, and then we're going to also have appropriation details presented by Commissioner Mark Myers, Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources, with Deputy Commissioner Marty Rutherford. We also have via teleconference Donna Kepper's Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue, in case we have revenue questions available for her. With that, Commissioner Pat. We will go through the presentation and then we will ask questions.
So, thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Pat Pitney. I'm Director for Office of Management and Budget. With that, happy Saturday. Oh, that too. Okay. So this presentation really covers five major topics. What we've spent to date on Alaska LNG, what's included in this supplemental appropriation, an explanation of why the supplemental is 157 compared to the 108 that people had heard in the spring, fall, and the summer, spring, summer, and fall, and then changes to the pre-feed phase. I think a lot of these, fortunately, have been covered in your several of your hearings already this week, so some of this will be just a review. Lastly, how much would it cost to complete the remaining phases? So that will start right in. So funding to date for the Alaska AK LNG project is $90.5 million. There were three components, primary components of that. One is the SB 138 general funds to the LNG fund. This was in fiscal year 14 and 15, and it totaled $69.8 million. So first, it capitalized the LNG fund, and then secondly, it funded AGDC and the Alaska AK LNG downstream cash calls and contractual services with agencies. So a lot of that, some of that was RSA to different departments for service to AGDC on their behalf. In fiscal year 15, there was
acronyms.
Thank you. Good reminder. In fiscal year 15, there was $11.8 million, roughly, in general funds, and it provided for three areas of support for AKLNG. First was AEA's an in-state affordability study on energy, and this was to look at energy requirements outside of the area that would be available on the gas line. So looking at rural and other areas within Alaska that wouldn't be directly serviced by the pipeline, and what would their needs be as we look forward to make it a fair approach. Then there was appropriations to the North Slope Gas Commercialization in DNR and in the tax division to carry out the functions of roles in 138. Lastly, in fiscal year 16, there was just short of $9 million appropriated to the North Slope Gas Commercialization. This request was just over a $13 million reduction, or $13 million request, and only $9 million was covered. It created a so this is a shortfall causing the supplemental. that we're asking for today, or one of the components of the shortfall. Lastly, in fiscal year 16, because of available capacity within the original 69 million to cover the operating costs primarily of AGDC, there was authorization from the LANG fund of $3 million. This was within the original $69 million capitalization. The two components for DNR, it was $150,000 for DNR and $71,000 for DOT. So fairly small out of that $3 million. It was primarily AGDC's operating costs. So stepping into now this particular supplemental request. This request has three components. One, it's the agency operating budgets to support the AK LNG project. That's $13.6 million. You can see there DNR at $2 million, Department of Revenue, $1.3 million, Department of Law, $10 million. Then it funds the AGDC capital budget, and this is, there's two components to that. It's $68 million. For the buyout of TransCanada and $75 million for the remaining pre-feed share for the state. And I'll go into that in more detail to explain why that pre-feed share is what it is. Lastly, there's statutory designated receipt authority requested of $5 million. AGDC did work on behalf of all of the partners within the AK LNG project. This provides them the ability to receive that money and essentially reimburse themselves for the work that was done on behalf of all the project partners. So, okay. So, why did we go from 108 to 157? So, primarily, and actually if we go back here, the 108 related to just the AGDC portion of this request. So it really went from 108 to 144. And the main reason that changed, or the only reason that changed, is because there was a pre-feed scope and schedule increase for the entire, all of the partners of $182 million. Okay, so it went from $511 million to $694 million. And this is split between all the partners. So the state share of the 173, which is out, the difference between 173 and the 182 is the kind of the office, the number of months extension between there. But the 173 is $66 million. So there's $66 million associated with the liquefaction plant of the increase. There's $107 million associated with the midstream, so the gas treatment plant and the pipe. So of that increase, if we were looking at the piece that AGDC does, the downstream, that's $66 million. And we look at the midstream piece, that's $107 million. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I know we're not supposed to ask questions, but thank you. I'm. Could you do that all over again?
Okay. Let's start here.
Okay.
Let's start here, and we'll go back to that. So my apologies. So you have prior to the pre-feed increase, we were anticipating, we had estimated 108. Well, the actual cost, if we didn't have the increase, would have been $106.8 million. And there were three components of that. It's the TransCanada component that they've already spent, plus the remaining cash calls for the midstream area that we as a state would have to pick up. So that's under the 108. Now, there was the increase from 511 to 694 million. That created the change. And so there's now four components. You have the $68.4 million for the buyout, which just stays the same. That's what TransCanada has spent on our behalf. It's the 29 original estimate on the midstream cash calls. And then it's $31 million for the midstream cash call increase. And then for our downstream, so the liquefaction plant, it's another $15 million associated with that. So if we kick back to this one, so it was $66 million for the liquefaction plant. And so our share of that $66 million is $15 million. It's 107 for this midstream GDP, and our share of that is 31 million.
Pat, I think just for clarification, was the increase in the request because the gas line development team moved some of the projects from the feed into the pre-feed?
Right. So if we look down, yes.
No.
What was the reason for the increase?
Okay. So if we look down and further down here at the bottom of this slide. So there were four pieces of the change. One is to have a higher level of specifics and accuracy in the optimization of the design. So that is essentially, that would be something that you would move from feed, that what is planned to be done in feed, that moved back to pre-feed. Second, we're accelerating regulatory work and pre-bid work for feed contracting, so that when we come out of pre-feed, and if a feed decision is made, we are ready within a very short time frame to put the contracts on the street.
They're changed for the request and the scope for the project.
So
department?
It was an entire team, but I will let Deputy Commissioner Rutherford.
Mr. Chairman, Marty Rutherford, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Natural Resources. This is the project, the AKLNG project, which is managed by a management team made up of representatives from each of the three producers, currently TransCanada and AGDC. So it was a project scope change that added additional cost to complete the pre-feed work.
As requested by the project development team.
So geohazards work and bringing the pipeline concept design on the 48 to the same level as the 42 are the other two components of that cost increase. Okay. So we've covered that one. So next time, I'll put that one first next time. So now getting down to so that explains the $144 million request. And going into the agency operating requests in support of the project. We'll start with Department of Natural Resources, and I will turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Rutherford and have her do that. And then when we get to the Department of Revenue, we will ask Donna to work with that, and then I can follow up with any other questions.
Mr. Chairman, again, Marty Rutherford, Department of Natural Resources, Deputy Commissioner. Let me just start by saying there are certain aspects of 138 that are the responsibility of the department, and the most important ones are negotiating the upstream commercial agreements associated with gas supply and gas balancing, upstream cost allowance, disposal costs. Those are the kind of issues to ensure that we have a reasonable sharing of cost among all the project interest owners. We also have a role in negotiating the midstream issues to ensure that expansion and third-party access is accommodated by this project. This will have a huge effect on our future lease sales. It will have a huge effect on existing and future exploration and development companies who have some interest in exploring for and monetizing gas supplies. And we have an incredibly important role associated with marketing the gas itself. That is part of the commercial negotiations as well. As I'm sure you've heard, joint venture marketing equity marketing are both under consideration. Additionally, SB 138 specifically provided that each of the three working in, producers in the AKLNG project provide the DNR commissioner with an offer to purchase the state's gas for their for themselves to market. So all of those alternatives are under consideration by DNR. As part of that, there's sort of three pieces of what we're requesting. I just might note that back in for this fiscal year 15 fiscal year, DNR had actually requested approximately $13 million. We were funded just under $9 million. It was a $4 million shortfall of our request and what we our expected expenditures were going to be. We understood that. We were clearly told that if this became a problem, to come back in a supplemental request. And since the special session came along, we decided to take advantage of it now because we will be expending money fairly intensively between now and the second quarter of 2016 as we try to finalize the commercial agreements.
Mr. Rutherford, if you go through this, could you just put the numbers next to the discussions that you're talking about? So there's $70 million. To cover the cost that TC has incurred on behalf of the state's partnership within the LNG project management team for services already done. Then you've got the other funds. If it's, please specify if it's a supplemental request or if it's a request for additional work to be required because of the scope change. So I'm just trying to, as you're talking the money, I want to just identify exactly where it goes and how much each time you do that so it's clear for members.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely we can do that. What I'm speaking to right at the moment is only the DNR supplemental request for the remainder of this fiscal year.
So, if we look, it's...
Can I ask you something? Thank you. I totally understand the problem with asking questions during the middle of a presentation, and it usually takes longer, and usually the smarter thing to do is wait till the end. In this presentation, the numbers are odd enough, and the questions are weird enough that I don't know.
Hey, we got all day. We got
I don't know whether
day.
You would
so
reconsider.
Let's go ahead and let's start doing some of these questions as we go along because they're going to be coming along anyhow. So we've got today. So probably better. This is somewhat confusing, I think, because we haven't seen this presentation until we've just gotten it here recently. So let's just go ahead and do it that way. I think. So if we're here till midnight, we're here till midnight. It doesn't matter. We should ask the question, so we'll do it that way. Representative Guerra.
Yeah. Sir, can I ask the one question I'm confused about? So. Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome Representative Pruitt.
So I think there's probably a good answer to my question, but... I've never built a gas line before, just in case anybody thought I have. And right now we've got Exxon, Conoco, BP, and the state getting their own gas marketer. There's a part of SB 138 that we changed in finance. They tried to change it in resources, too, that gives us the option to just let the majors sell the gas, and we get our gas sold at the best terms that they get for themselves. So we're not cheated. That would be one option. And so the natural question comes, I guess, why couldn't we just at this point of the project have one gas marketer for all parties? Everybody would have to agree. Maybe they wouldn't. And I guess there are conflicts. I guess if you're a company that's not as interested in the project as you're letting on, maybe you won't do a very good job. If you're over-interested in selling the project because you're really interested in the project, maybe you'll oversell the gas price. I don't know. But is there any way to have one gas marketer for all the parties on this? Because right now it's like pre-feed. Or can we just not rely on each other for that?
Mr. Myers?
Thank you for that question, Representative Guerra, through the chair, and also Deputy Commissioner Mark Rutherford and I will probably jointly answer this question. But the marketing... Mark Myers, Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources. Thank you. The one of the challenges with marketing natural gas to overseas markets is lack of transparency in general in the structure. And then the warranting that you have to do to deliver your gas and the coordination it takes because it's not sold on the spot market, very little sold on the spot market, sold on long-term contracts, so you have to make long-term commitments and guarantees. So when you look at those factors, first of all, you have to assure supply. You have to be have a trusting relationship with them, and the prices and the contracts are indexed. A project of this size won't have a single contract. It will have many contracts. And there's no single party out there that's going to buy all our gas. It's simply not, unless you sell it to some aggregator, and that's going to be heavily discounted if you sell it to an aggregator. So the reality is lots of contracts moving through the system. We can know when our experience in, and what you described with the producer selling the gas is fundamentally what we do under REV, whereas the producer seller, and we get the higher of value in the field of any of the producers. We've known through that process one of the challenges has been transparency. Again, when you're selling multiple contracts, gas moves very complexly, tracking the molecules and ensuring you get your actual price is a very difficult thing to do. Again, so most of the time when the producers will come to offer to sell you gas, to be your marketer, they'll offer you a price in the market. And again, as a, it's their job as producers to largely make money on all aspects of the business, including the sales piece of it. So a contract, you'd be guaranteeing the price, but then I'm sure they will try to exceed that price in the market. Again, in REV, they don't do that. They can't do that. But we have to be able to trace the molecules or have a market basket or some other mechanism through our reopener processes to deal with it. So realistically, when you look at a marketing, a joint venture marketing process is preferable. If you're going to have them market, you're going to market with them. That way your people are seconded into their project. You are literally an equal partner with equal information flow. So you're not external to the box. You're inside the box. So that joint venture marketing is a really important mechanism to market. Now, some producers prefer joint venture marketing. Some prefer equity marketing. Some it varies by region and by partner. So it's a complex deal that has to be negotiated. For instance, one company may say, I really want us to jointly market this project altogether with joint venture marketing. And again, from our perspective at DNR, that's the cleanest, easiest, lowest cost, and highest fidelity way to do this. But all the producers would have to agree to do that. And they may or may not choose to do that. So that's negotiations. So hopefully, Marty, you want to add to that?
I would, Mr. Chair. Representative Garrett, through the chair, I think it's important to back up because everything Mark has said is true, but just to give you sort of the background of this, there's one particularly good reason why it is not possible for more than one party to work on marketing gas. There are serious antitrust issues. Negotiations must be done in a bilateral fashion with gas marketers. Where there's
speed things up here, I believe each member of the gas pipeline, each owner of the gas is responsible for selling their own gas, is the answer.
Yes, sir, and there are legal limitations to them doing it together. And let me just go on for a minute, because there are commercial negotiations going on that will determine what the recommendations from the state will be on the marketing structure. If, as Commissioner Myers indicated, we recommend a joint venture market structure with one or more of the parties, they have to be set up very carefully, very specifically, in order not to trigger antitrust issues. So that is something that's under discussion, as is equity marketing, as is selling the gas directly to each company, which is, you know, under 138 has to make some offers to Department of Natural Resources. The reason why we need our person now is because we have not determined what that structure will be. We are limited to bilateral conversations and with potential purchasers, and we need advice as to what is the appropriate structure that the state of Alaska should embrace, or a combination of structures, and to begin to develop that structure internally so that we have a full package to present to the legislature when we come forward with the commercial agreements.
So what I'd like to do, too, is let's try and keep questions to the budget that we're looking at. I mean, we can be asking lots of questions here of DNR and OMB, but this was a presentation about their budget requests. So let's get through the budget requests. If you've got questions specifically on the budget requests and things that are in the presentation here, let's take them. If we've got, and then we'll move on to other questions that can expand beyond that.
this could take a long time, and we could go down a lot of trails and just get away from the budget here, and I want to stay focused on the budget. Representative Kawasaki.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we go through the agency operating budget, I just wanted to hear if some of these or all of these requests are specifically because of the change in scope that AGDC made. And I don't know if that's the case or if they're totally separated. Yeah.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, these costs would exist without the scope change because it's a representation of the state in the project. So had the scope not changed and we were still taking on the Trans-Canada role, the acceleration of the project and the state's role in moving the project more urgently requires these costs. So they are not associated with the scope change. They're associated with moving the project, moving the state's interest in the project.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Ms. Rutherford.
So specific to the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Revenue and the Department of Law requests, they are all associated with the commercial negotiations associated with the project. The project piece is now going to be held by AGDC and those work plan and budget numbers. So that's where the accelerated pre-feed impact resides.
So I guess just to follow up and understand.
Kawasaki, ask it to keep it.
So because of the new pre-feed and scope changes, and is there a need to move the commercialization forward faster, or is it just timely now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, in order to keep the project on schedule for the intended operational time frame of end of 2024 to 2025, you have to back up to finishing the pre-feed in 2016, early 2017. In order to get the commercial agreements done, you have to have the ability to have a constitutional vote by the next general election, which is November 8th, 2016. Which requires that we have our commercial agreements to you in late second quarter of this coming year. So this next two quarters, the end of this calendar year and the next two quarters, are going to be incredibly intense negotiations on all the commercial agreements. And that's what is driving these additional appropriations to the agencies.
And again, if there's specific questions that we've got on the presentation, let's ask them. If not, let's ask broad range questions when we're done. Go ahead. First we have Representative Edgman and Sadler.
I'll wait.
Representative Sadler. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think this is a broad range, but maybe it is, so I apologize. But I guess my bigger question is, when we talk about marketing and we talk about the marketing person, and certainly there's been a lot of a write-up about the $840,000 person, but I really want to speak to that particular cost, and I don't know what the industry pays for that kind of a person. I'm not in the industry. So what I'm really asking is, what's the going rate, and do we know other companies that pay that going rate?
Representative Gaddis, to the chair, the state looked at and benchmarked those costs. In other words, we used human capital, which is a recruitment and executive leadership for oil and gas industry folks. And so we benchmarked that. We also benchmarked it with Black & Veatch, and those were the numbers we came back with. We also conferred with our colleague, Audie Sutters, who has retired from Chevron as a gas marketer. So those prices represent the range, and hopefully the upper end of the range. So we didn't want to come, because it's absolutely critical that we get the best because of the swing in value that's there in terms of how we market and how we negotiate the markets and how we assure, again, in this process, during that negotiations, both internally with the style of marketing that we're going to lock in with the producers, that we're effective and that we're credible in that discussion, but also with the markets themselves. As the project moves forward into feed, we have to align those contracts by the end of feed. We have to have locked in the contracts, otherwise the project won't be financed. So these are the costs. Yeah, these are the costs that are appropriate to that career field. One of the challenges is the budget requires, typically these people are paid a large bonus, can be equal to their salary, or sometimes greater than their salary. So their base salaries aren't that high, but when you put the bonuses in, and then you've got to recruit them and get them to get out of the mainstream in Houston and have them live up in Alaska. And for most of us, that's an exciting opportunity, but cost of living is higher and convincing them to come. So again, that is a benchmark range, and I think you heard from the analytical consultants as well saying that's the range. Again, it's you can hire a lot of commissioners for that cost, but that's realistically how it was benchmarked.
So, Mr. Chair, and it does basically what I'm hearing you say, that's the going rate. It's certainly a bonus is paid if they produce, and I've worked in sales, and so I certainly understand that. And so as we move forward, what I'm also asking is this a long-term contract? Will we be doing that every year for the next 20-plus years, or is this something that we're going to condense for now, and do we expect this to continue at this rate?
President Gaddis, to the chair. We see actually having to build up a larger marketing group than a single marketer. The single marketer is to help us structure, build, and negotiate these early contracts. And then, depending on the style of marketing, we're more or less labor-intensive.
We'll get to those questions as soon as we get done with the presentation. If we can stay on the presentation so we can get through it. Maybe some of the answers probably are coming. Representative Wilson?
Do
you have a question on the presentation?
Yeah, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying just to get the difference on the numbers. I'm sorry. So we had 694 that it went to. We were at 511 million, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so that's a difference of 183 million of the increase. So are we required to be 25% of that 183?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes.
Okay. Sorry, I have to do my math faster. Okay, so that's how then we come to. I'm really trying to follow the numbers there, and I'm just getting really lost in all the different ones. Okay, so then that would be, by fat math, $48 million difference that would be our cost as the 25% owner, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, correct.
And Mr. Chair, then, so here's where my problem is then. I have, by your numbers, that it would have been $37 million difference instead of $48 million.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, within, if you look here on this slide, within the funding we estimated, there was an allowance for midstream scope changes of $8.8 million. So that was available to cover those additional costs. So the increase is what we required is the 31, or is the difference between 8 and 31 and 15. So there was a contingency built in for scope changes when last spring, last summer, when we were talking about 108, it included an allowance for scope changes in the midstream area. Because now we know what the scope changes are, that eight can be applied. So that comes off of your $48 million.
So I took all those numbers, and so, you know, when I took the $31 million that you have up there, you know, underneath the new amount, and I took off the $8.8 million, that gave me $22.2 million. Okay, and then I added in the $15 million for the allowance for AGTC, and that's where I came up with $37.2 million. And then I times that by four because there's four shares, 25, 25. And I know all those numbers are different when it comes to the other three, but for our discussion, we have the 25, which would have been a change of $148.8 million for everyone. And that's why I'm trying to come up that 148. Should match the 183, and it doesn't. So that's
through the chair, Representative Wilson. It's because that 8.8 that you subtracted actually counts towards that scope change.
So we have not paid it yet.
We haven't paid it yet, and we can apply that to the scope change.
And only the 8.8 we haven't paid.
Right.
Of those numbers, correct?
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm there.
Go ahead, Pat. Commissioner or whoever.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So basically what I was just wrapping up is the responsibilities, some of the responsibilities, the most important ones that the Department of Natural Resources has under SB 138. So now moving down to the bottom of slide number 7, we are requesting some personal services, which I'll talk about in a minute, in the amount of $646,000. We're requesting some additional contractual money in the amount of $1,500,480. In the personal services, this is where we are requesting the additional money to hire this extremely high-level marketing lead that will begin to represent the state of Alaska as we move into a gas marketer in whatever structure we determine is appropriate. Even if we were to become an equity marketer, we would need a lead marketing person. If we become a member of a joint venture market structure, we will need a lead marketing structure so that we have an equal representative of the state at the table when marketing purchase agreements or when purchase agreements on the gas are considered and developed. So this is the beginning of developing the structure that ultimately will be in place for the state of Alaska. It also, this position will also help us analyze what is the appropriate structure or combination of structures that we will bring to you in the spring 2016 and recommend how the state position itself moving into this entirely new industry. So the other portion of the $646,000. So there is an additional $480,000 that we're adding to an existing $360,000 to get this gas marketing lead. That's an existing position. We're requesting additional money for the remainder of fiscal year 615, and obviously then we'd be back as part of our regular budget in fiscal year 16 as a total request. We are also requesting a new position to assist that person. It would be a marketing analyst who would be part of this new team that begins to structure the state's marketing organization moving forward. Additionally, we are requesting we had been requesting $580,000 to reimburse the Department of Natural Resources for sort of supporting the AKLNG commercial negotiations moving forward. We are changing that request to $303,500 because we're eliminating some of the backfill positions where it's less than 50% or 50% or less that they are supporting AKLNG. However, there are still two positions that we feel we need to be able to replace within the Division of Oil and Gas. These are both both commercial part analysts, commercial managers within the Division of Oil and Gas. To date, they have been providing 80 to 90% of their work over the last year to the AKLNG commercial negotiations. It's been in the area of helping us analyze issues associated with RIK, with upstream reservoir information, with what we'll need to protect the state's interest as a gas transporter and marketer. So they are no longer available to the Division of Oil and Gas. The Division of Oil and Gas is engaged in commercial negotiations on a daily basis. There are six positions in that division. Two of them have not been filled because of budget cuts. Two of them are available for the division work, and two of them have been completely taken off to be committed to AKLNG. So we are requesting $300,000 to provide the ability to hire two new additional commercial analysts within the Division of Oil and Gas for the remainder of this year so that we don't slide further behind on our ongoing oil and gas commercial management responsibilities. And then finally, we are requesting $900,000 for our contractual services. This is related to the additional time that is being spent by the subject matter experts that are mostly under contract to the Department of Natural Resources that assist us in every aspect of the commercial negotiations we've commented on, and virtually every aspect of the package that will be brought forward to you in the spring of 2016. So that brings us to the $1.8 million we are requesting of you. Originally it was 2.125, now we've lowered it to 1.850. So that wraps up the formal presentation, and obviously we can answer any questions you'd like.
Means we'll just throw this away anyhow. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Pitney, actually, relating to what Marty just said, as I understand it, Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, Marty, you're asking to have some of your employees in DNR who are being, their work is being focused on AKLNG work, to be paid for with AKLNG funds. Is that correct?
Correct.
Shouldn't we see a corresponding reduction in the general fund money that has already been appropriated to pay for their services as regular departmental line employees?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, no, because basically what we're asking is that the ones who have been currently paid by Division of Oil and Gas funds, the two that have been reassigned virtually 100% of their time over to AKLNG, be reimbursed by AKLNG funds, therefore freeing up the general fund money within Division of Oil and Gas to backfill those two positions so they're available to do the original oil and gas work.
Representative Sadler, to the chair, if I could add to that, having been director of oil and gas for 5 years, I can tell you those commercial analysts are worth their weight in gold. They're the ones that do our RIK sales, and we have proposals for RIK oil sales as we're going, three of them right now, which will be delayed if we don't have commercial analysts to in-state refineries. They're the ones that develop our lease sale terms as we go forward on our various lease sales. They are the ones that evaluate commercial terms on our unitization issues. And as you know, we have many new units coming in. I can go on the backfill and the delay that will happen if we can't backfill those positions. Thank you.
Okay. I have a few questions. Mr. Myers, one of the reasons we asked you here today is to get on record the issue of who votes for the state on December 4th for the work program and budget. We did receive a letter yesterday from the governor, but I'd like to still get your clarifications on the record. Assuming the appropriation is made and all agreements are signed in order to buy out TransCanada, which state organization will be casting a vote on the work plan and budget?
Representative Newman, to the chair, so if the buyout happens, then the vote will be cast by AGDC in terms of for the state for the work plan and budget.
So if it's AGDC, who's going to direct the way AGDC employees should vote? The AGDC board or somebody else? How's that work?
Representative Newman, to the chair, the AGDC vote is the vote of the state. So in that process, we will advise from the perspective of the commercial terms necessary, but the vote is basically to move forward an established, developed work plan and development. So I see no issues with that vote. It's either going to be we're going to vote for it or we're not at that point in time. And if we don't vote for it, the project terminates. So I think it's a pretty straightforward process.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add to that, I mean, I'd like to clarify something. The state of Alaska has been working with AGDC on many of the commercial agreements that are affect the project, the GTP, the gas treatment plant, the pipeline, and the liquefaction plant. If the appropriation is made by the legislature to buy out TransCanada or to terminate the precedent agreement with TransCanada, the interests that TransCanada holds in the pipeline and the GTP will be transferred to AGDC. AGDC will continue to work with the state agencies for input on how what we think of the WP work plan and budget, but AGDC board will direct the vote by the representative to the management team to the project.
You mentioned AGDC will work with the department on the work plan, as but only on requests that are made by AGDC, as the permitting requests that will have to be done on a on the project, or how does it work?
Mr. Chairman, as we move through this phase of developing commercial agreements that affect the state's interest, there are portions of those that are led by AGDC, such as the governance of the project. The governance of the project will be the actual interest owners of the project. Assuming AGDC holds the, all the state's interest in all three elements of the project, it would be AGDC, ExxonMobil, British BP, and ConocoPhillips. They have representatives on the management team. They will be the ones to vote. However, the commercial agreements that we are all involved in negotiating are, they have elements that are of great importance to the sovereign, and such as expansion, third-party access, withdrawal, those kind of issues. You know, to what degree do we get information? To what degree do we have a vote? Does it require all four parties to agree, or is it a majority vote? There will be all those questions embedded in the, some of the various agreements. We all are having input to that and discussions about what that will look like, what are the state's interests. So as we're going through the next phases before the project becomes fully solidified on structure and governance, the state sovereign agencies will have input to AGDC about what we think is in the state's interest. But at the end of the day, when AGDC holds our interests, they will actually hold our vote, too, and the board of directors will direct that vote.
On that point, Mr. Myers, according to the state of Alaska's Alaska LNG gas team organizational chart that you provided to the members, you are listed as a decision maker for the Department of Natural Resources. Commissioner, have you signed a confidentiality agreement that allows you to see information considered confidential by the AK LNG project?
Representative Newman, I have not. Could I further elaborate, though?
How can you make key decisions to negotiate agreements concerning the project, then?
Mr. Chairman,
we've been told that when the project development team comes in, and if somebody's developed a compressor and they have specific information for their components in there, that's confidential information. And we've been told that members of the Alaska's team have had to leave the room so that they can have those discussions or go talk about something else that's been disruptive. So again, you're listed as a decision maker without signing a confidentiality agreement. How could we get this far? And do you feel that it probably has slowed discussions down then?
Mr. Chairman, the way we have handled it was the Attorney General and the Governor really produced a letter saying that he believed that commissioners, in fact, were not required as senior decision makers, similar to a CEO or senior vice president at a corporation, were not required to sign confidentiality to see the data. In addition, we were working on an agreement that was clear and concise. Okay, I apologize. Worked with the producers. For instance, when I would go to a sponsors meeting, the producers, I would email back to them that I would hold the information confidential. So we found a mechanism to move information back and forth rather successfully. In addition, there are data sets that are critical to this project that are held confidential under other means in state government. So, for instance, our upstream data and supply issues, and balancing the equity in the lease, removing the net profit share leases, that's all done under DNR's existing authority and confidentiality. So the subset of data that's specific to AKLNG is not as big as you would think. But it is. There are certain issues that are, and we have worked with the producers, and I have seen, obviously acknowledge, I have seen adequate confidential data.
Mr. Chairman, may I add something?
Representative, or
Ms. Rutherford.
Thank you. The information that has been provided that has been AKLNG confidential has been provided by the producers themselves to the executives in the administration. And so there have been what's called sponsors meetings where the Attorney General, the commissioners have been involved, where the sponsors themselves, the producer sponsors, have rolled out confidential information. And so they have accepted, to some degree, the ability of the executives to participate in the discussion without having signed the AKLNG.
I just hear you say that you have full meetings or pretend meetings on this. I don't. Is that what I just heard?
No, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Meetings about the meetings?
No, sir, Mr. Chairman. There's a group that are called the sponsors. They are made up of the highest level representatives of the parties who have interest in the project. When the sponsors get together, there have been times when the Attorney General or the commissioners have been involved in those meetings, invited to those meetings, where the producers themselves have shared AKLNG confidential information. So that is the primary method by which the commissioners have been receiving confidential information from AKLNG.
On that point,
thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm a little confused on the separation of all this. It seems like you're telling me that AGDC is going to be the one making the decisions and doing the voting at the management team level, yet they are not allowed to sign a confidentiality agreement. So now we're going to have them step out of the room and have the Attorney General or Mark Myers step into the room to make that decision. And now AGDC is out of the loop completely. I'm confused as to why this is going on and what's the problem with confidentiality agreements. I mean, they're common in the industry, of every industry, especially in this where they've got so much technical information, so much. One company in Sweden's got this, so many over here has this. How are we supposed to be able to have an informed decision if they won't even present to the management team because we have somebody without a confidentiality agreement signed? I don't see what the problem is with this, because in HB4 and SB 138, we gave specific authority for AGDC to sign robust confidentiality agreements. Now we're trying to change that. The legislature sees the importance of confidentiality agreements. Why are we dealing with this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson, through the chair, I must have confused you, and I apologize for that. I would like to clarify that there's a huge distinction between the project, the management team, the management committee on the project, and the commercial discussions. The management committee on the project is currently represents the state's interest through AGDC, Joe Dubler, and TransCanada. If the TransCanada proceeding agreement is terminated, AGDC, probably through Joe Dubler, although they would have to clarify that, will continue to make the project decisions. He, Joe Dubler, has signed the AKLNG confidentiality agreement. The only people that are involved in the AKLNG commercial discussions that have not signed the confidentiality agreements are at the highest levels: the commissioners, the Attorney General, and the governor. And the Commissioner of Natural Resources, Mark Myers, the Commissioner of Revenue.
He didn't.
No. The only people who did not sign the AKLNG confidentiality agreements are the two commissioners, the Attorney General, and the governor. They have not. And it has been the opinion of the state administration to the producers that, just like their executives, they are not required to. So functionally, it's been working. But the distinction between the project and the commercial discussions needs to be real clear, because AKLNG, all the staff at AGDC, that work on AKLNG, I believe, have also signed the confidentiality, just like all the staff in the agencies have signed the confidentiality.
Representative Thompson, and we'll...
Little follow-up on this with the regulations that have been proposed and have been having public comment for changing the confidentiality agreement requirements by AGDC. Those could change going into the future. You have some people that have signed with AGDC confidentiality agreements, but does this new regulations change that for future people to sign confidentiality agreements?
Marty, let me...
Let me just respond initially. Representative Thompson, through the chair, I am not familiar. I have heard there are new confidentiality regs that have been proposed by AGDC. I am personally not familiar with them. I think if there are questions about those regulations, they are best directed to AGDC.
Commissioner? Representative Thompson, the chair, I was going to say the same thing. That discussion about regs in AGDC doesn't pertain, as my knowledge, to any of the resource agencies, DOR, DNR, or the Department of Law that's not working directly with AGDC. So you're talking about an internal matter with AGDC that I can't warranty because I don't know anything about it. I can say I understand the need for confidentiality within a project. There's clearly, and it is my hope, that AGDC in the future will second people into the project. They do not have anyone seconded in there now, and I think having people fully seconded and in the project at all levels of that project is critical just to represent the state's 25% ownership. So the issue needs to get worked out. But we do not know.
Design a confidentiality agreement to be a secundee.
Representative Thompson, to the chair, the question is, what does that agreement look like? It's not that you don't need agreement. You clearly do. But is that agreement appropriately, or is it too broad or too narrow in its scope? And I can't answer the question because we're not a party to those discussions. That's between AGDC and their represented attorneys.
I believe under Senate Bill 138 gave Alaska Gas Line Development Authority, known as AGDC, the ability to have a blanket over them as far as the Freedom of Information Act or some Public Information Act so that they could enter into discussions with companies that have proprietary information. It's also my understanding that the request for a change in regulation by AGDC to now ask for a change in regulations to change that specific scope that was required in Senate Bill 138 that gave them authority to enter into that is causing many of the other, not just the producers, but people who, again, who have a compressor with confidential information or something like that because it's proprietary, it's slowing down the whole project because there's not been an answer yet. And if there's a regulation change that allows them to enter into these negotiations and have these discussions, but they're not covered by that authority, that's been an issue with quite a few of the different players in there. Who requested the regulation change that AGDC has laid out there?
Representative Newman, the challenge that we have, Mr. Chairman, is that we honestly don't know. This agreement, DNR is not a party to that particular confidentiality agreement. We have no knowledge. I would suggest that you bring in the chairman of the board of AGDC or the president and possibly their attorneys who are working the issue because we just can't tell you. We don't know.
I believe that we've made that request. So there's been no request from the department or with anything with anybody within the administration that AGDC asked for this regulation change?
Representative Newman, Mr. Chairman, we honestly do not know. Again, AGDC reports to an independent board. They do not report to our structure. And you can see on the diagram, again, Mr. Fauske is on a lateral line to me. He does not report to me. He reports to a board and to a governor.
AGDC is on the agenda tomorrow, so we'll discuss that, and we're going to stick to the DNR commercial agreements that will stay on that. So the confidentiality agreement question is key to the commercial negotiations that we're working on currently. The DNR commission is responsible for that. So are the partners reluctant to enter into commercial agreements unless they're confident?
Representative Newman, Mr. Chairman, in fact, I have not seen that. We recognize the challenges of me not signing that document early, and I believe there's the communication I'm receiving, the information I'm receiving from the companies is adequate. There's a long history here, again, of working with DNR on confidential data, and to my knowledge, DNR has never breached a confidential agreement in the 30 years or so I've been involved. So there's a fair amount of trust in that relationship, and I will not divulge confidential information.
Have you requested?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman?
You requested to see the confidentiality agreement so you could start reviewing it?
Mr. Chairman, I discussed this with the governor and with the attorney general about whether we should sign these agreements or not. The conclusion was we should not do it. So I respect my boss in that matter. And we found a way to work through that solution. And that was based on the advice coming out that senior executives are not required to be under that confidentiality to receive the information.
So I think what I heard is the governor and the attorney general suggested that you not sign confidentiality agreements. That's what he just said.
Mr. Chairman, let me correct that. I did not ask to sign or not sign the agreement. I was aware there was an issue. If we could not see confidential information, there's an issue with responsibility that I have as Commissioner of National Resources and a decision maker. Because of the governor's statement and the memo that said to the producers clearly that senior executives are not under the confidentiality yet need to see confidential data, that has been adequate and has worked for us. It's made some folks uncomfortable, but the reality is it has been working as far as I can tell. And I've worked with a lot of industry data and confidential data and have not seen a blockage of information. I've also been very respectful of keeping information confidential.
And here's the problem, and I cannot see how this would not slow the project down. Your own organizational chart that said you're a key decision maker plus the other commissioners, and you have not signed a confidentiality agreement, and we've got to have this bound up and ready to go by December 4th. I asked you if you thought that would slow down the project. I asked if that would slow down the project, and you said that it would. So I'm concerned about that, and we'll get into further discussions on that, and I'm sure many other members have other questions. I have a couple more here. Commissioner, on Monday we're having a presentation that goes to the Senate Bill 138 to remind us that AKLNG was laid out, specific goals in there. Under that vision of legislation, DNR, in consultation with Department of Revenue, was to negotiate commercial agreements, market royalty in kind and taxes gas, and modified leases as part of the royalty kind and tax and gas agreements, taxes gas. Further, in a letter from the governor yesterday, he affirmed that the statutes, Alaska Statute 380502, gives DNR and the Department of Revenue the authorities and obligations to negotiate the associated commercial agreements and dispose of the gas of the LNG export project. I'd like to discuss who's actually negotiating the commercial agreements for the state. There's a $10 million supplemental request in the Department for Law for drafting, negotiating, and reviewing LNG contracts for the Department of Law. Well, the $10 million worth of attorneys at law that they're seeking be negotiating in commercial agreements?
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Law's support, direct support through their attorneys and through the attorneys of Milbanks, Greenberg, Trolling, are critical to our success because the attorney generals, assistant attorney generals, really understand Alaska law, but the external lawyers really understand LNG and have a long, long history of working on complex LNG projects. So they are crucial to the team in the negotiating team, which will include, as you saw in the box, on the various issues on the org chart. These are the various teams that are negotiating the various agreements. That chart is actually not the chart of the operational organization. It's the chart of the commercial structure to negotiate the long-term structure. So you can see in that chart the various functions and the various positions and which attorneys are doing which pieces. I will say that that fund is crucial because this is the third version of the gas line that I've participated in, but lots of other oil and gas agreements, that the companies will be spending more than that, significantly more than that independently on their side as we negotiate. So it's just to create a parity in the negotiations of the team, but those specified experts on LNG are really important to calibrate this agreement versus others they've negotiated worldwide. So again, we are looking at complex issues, lots of complex issues, a short time period to negotiate these issues, multiple teams working at a given time on multiple issues in order to make this work. And you can see the agreements on the right, again, excuse me, on your screen. These are very difficult, complex agreements, so that legal support is absolutely necessary. But we do see it as legal support to the negotiating teams, the commercial people. And ultimately, my responsibility to sign those agreements, I have to be assured we've done all our due diligence and we've negotiated a deal that's acceptable to the state. And without that, then I can't come. We can't come back to you for approval of the structure and agreement in good faith. So those attorneys, again, are core to having a professional team in an LNG project when we are not experienced in LNG as a state. We're experienced in oil and gas, but not experienced in LNG is the particulars of this project and these negotiations.
Ms. Rutherford?
Mr. Chairman, I think that I'd just like to reemphasize that the legal team are assisting each of the commercial discussions that were at the bottom of the organizational chart. So it's a team approach, they are not driving it. They are not making the decisions. They are participating in the discussion as part of the team.
And we would probably appreciate on your organizational chart if we get one listing who has signed confidentiality agreements and who's not. So let's go to another part of the budget. Commissioner, according to the State of Alaska AKLNG State Gas Team organizational chart, Audie Setters is the gas marketing lead. Your department has requested an additional $480,000 for over $800,000 to add to the existing vacant position for marketing. We asked for further details a couple of days ago on the roles, responsibilities, and vision for this person and how that compares with the industry standards. It was asked again today. We're awaiting that answer. So if you could explain that and include this in your answers, please. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, this is Marty Rutherford, DNR and Deputy Commissioner. I had thought that was sent to you either late last night or early this morning, but it has been provided and it should be to you shortly, which is a further clarification on those roles and responsibilities. I just to be perfectly clear, though, on your question about Audie Setters, Mr. Setters is a contractor. He has been assisting the state to date. We firmly believe it is time to begin to institutionalize the state's capacity on gas marketing so that we can come up to speed and be a full participant and build that capacity within the state as we move into the actual project.
Why are marketing positions needed at this time? The state doesn't know how much gas we'll have. There's no royalty in kind or taxes gas decisions have been made yet. We don't know the responsible or the transportation costs of the state's gas or whether the state will market its gas independently. So why do we need those people now? We don't even know how much.
Mr. Chairman, lots of questions there. Let me try to take them systematically. Multiple functions to do this. What we inherited in 138 is a structure for commercial negotiations on the broadest scale. But first of all, is how we're going to, and you gave the department and the commissioner strict instructions that it had to receive higher value under RIK than I do royalty in kind than I do in royalty equal to or higher than in royalty in kind than I do in royalty in value. There are lots of ways to achieve a project. There are limited ways to achieve a project that maximize value at the wellhead for the state. Everything we're doing in this project with assumptions about value to the state, the general permanent fund, assumes a certain wellhead value. And that wellhead value is determined by the costs we pay upstream, the surety of supply of gas, our transportation costs, and our ability in what we get in the market. Right? Pretty simple. When you think of it, this is all about selling a commodity at a price that benefits maximize the benefits of that commodity price to Alaskan, in addition to the other advantages of jobs in state gas and infrastructure built in the state. But given that, you charged us with analyzing all the elements we've just talked about. The first thing else on these agreements, summarize those elements. A surety of gas supply means the gas balancing means we have to get gas out of two fields in predictable quantities, and when one field goes down a little bit, another field can make it up. That's what balancing is. It's a balancing so the full supply in your pipeline is full. If we have a pipeline that's not full for its first 15 years of operations, we lose money, and we lose a lot of money in this project. If we market to customers and can't guarantee supply, we have to sell that supply at a heavy discount. We lose money. So if we pay too much for transportation fees, we lose money. So every case, to preserve that upstream value, we have to negotiate agreements where they're fair to us, but they're also, we can calculate what those fees are going to be. Why? Because I have to compare it against an RIV structure, which is very different, to do that comparison as required in the finding that I have to deliver to you and you have to approve. That means we have to know how we're going to market going into these discussions early. Secondly, in that marketing piece of it, we have to not only know how we're going to do it, but we have to negotiate those agreements with our other producers. Again, a mechanism where we do joint venture marketing, we are a partner with them, and we have to have people of equal caliber to their people embedded in the structure. So therefore, if we're going to equity marketing, we need a whole team of people that can, independent of the producers, preserve value in those markets in wherever we sell it, Korea, Japan, et cetera. So the bottom line is we'll be one of the largest gas marketers in the world under this project. And 138, you changed the game from being passive to being an active investor. So being an active investor means you must build the technical capacity in your organization on all phases moving forward from now, because each one of those phases involves commercial negotiations at a greater, at a more finite level where more value is exchanged. So having that capacity and going into the room without capacity, at least a lead that can build that capacity, and a lead that is a state employee and accountable to the state. Again, consultants are good people. They're really skilled. They don't last with your organization for a period of time. They can be hired away. The knowledge base that they learn needs to be institutionalized, and then the other people that you bring in that need to work with that person or the team you build out has to be trained. These are simple facts. You can't do it. No one can do this. No one person can do this, but you need a leader to build the structure. So hopefully that explains the marketing piece of it. You need it now. Why? Because we're negotiating actively the marketing structure with the producers and the RIK finding, determining what the approximate values are going to be. As we move in toward feed, as we get into feed, then we're going to have to be actually marketing and making the contracts necessary to finance post-feed into FID. So we will have to have sold our gas before we get to feed. And you look around the corner, 3 or 4 years is not a long time. We are there, and we have one contractor in place now that has expertise in the subject matter, who is probably, I can say, who's a really good contractor, but he's building his house in Texas, his retirement home in Texas, which is what you'd expect him to do. So the reality is building that continuity requires that investment in people now. And that's what you signed us up for when you approved 138, and that's what we've been trying to honor. Professionalizing and building a corporate structure on the marketing side is a huge piece of the value stream of this project, and we want to do it professionally, and that means bringing in the right people at the right time to build it. We also want to minimize the number of people that we have in the structure. I mean, AGDC will have far more people in the structure than we'll ever have in DNR that related to this gas, even though we are doing the upstream of the marketing. That's a relatively small team. We're talking, if we do this right, of less than a half dozen people ultimately. Compare that to the structure you'll have embedded in the, seconded and embedded into the pipeline. It'll be a lot more. So on the scale, those boxes you see, most of those boxes in our structure go away when we get to through the construction and the operational phase. So again, these are complex negotiations. They take full teams of people to negotiate. We have to have those people in place. This is a lot. This is a very complex project, lots of players. It's one of the biggest projects in the world. It's a mega project, and we signed up not to be passive like we typically are. We signed up to be part of the business structure. And if we can't honor that business structure with the right people and the right budget, we will fail.
On page one of the supplemental backup detail, there's a sentence that says a gas marketing organization within DNR is an important step in preparing the state for successful gas, as you just stated, under the Alaska AKLNG or alternative project. Here's your information. AKLNG or alternative project. Is there an alternative project being considered?
Representative Newman, I know of no alternative project. I think what the governor has said, if this doesn't work, if this fails, he's still going to try to make efforts to monetize the gas on the North Slope and look at other options. And it depends on why it fails. And ultimately, what we are building is a specific marketing structure for this project. But that structure will depend on equity versus venture marketing. It depends on if it's a venture marketing, how many partners are involved with that, with that structure. So what we've done is create a flexible environment where we're bringing in the first people, and as we evolve it, then we'll go back to you and say, well, we're going to need another position here, and we'll need this over here, or we won't need it. So it's evolutionary with respect to this project. But our intent, and we've been very clear at DNR, is to make this project successful, to continue negotiations, to answering and get good contracts with these pieces. And again, we are in commercial negotiations. All parties are going to have to reach agreement. It's not just us. There are real disagreements in every one of these areas between us and each one of the individual producers. Their positions are very, very different often. So the reality is I can't tell you, because those are under confidentiality, where those negotiations are. But I can tell you, if you look at the various equity in the different fields, you look at the different business models, you look at their gas they deliver to these same markets, each one of these companies is positioned different and will leverage to maximize their individual position, and they should, just like the state should for theirs. So it is a tough four-way negotiations.
Timing is an issue with the TransCanada buyout for the process laid out in the precedent agreement. Is it the intent of the administration to fully terminate TransCanada prior to December 4?
Mr. Chairman, may I take this question?
Ms. Rutherford.
Thank you. We are absolutely intent upon, assuming you appropriate the monies for the to terminate the precedent agreement and pay TransCanada for their costs, and assuming you appropriate the money for the work plan and budget moving forward to AGDC, we are committed to having AGDC in place as the state's vote by December the 4th. We are currently actually putting together a presentation that Commissioner Myers will be giving tomorrow that lays out more detail associated with this, but there will be a document available that we hope to have ready for execution by the last week in November, so that everything just rolls with the interest being transferred to AGDC and check is cut to TransCanada, and we can move forward as the state's equity owners for all three elements of the project.
That will be the document that ensures the legislators that AGDC is going to have a voting seat.
Mr. Chairman, there may end up being three documents. We're in the process of determining that. We don't know whether one document can accommodate terminating the precedent agreement and with between TransCanada and DNR, or whether that same document can both terminate the relationship between TransCanada and DNR and actually convey the assets simultaneously to AGDC. But absolutely, we will be, as you know, executing all the necessary documents to accomplish that at the same time.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add, I know that in House Resources there was concern about DNR's intent, since the transfer could be to DNR before it goes to AGDC. It has always been my intent that the facilities should be owned and integrated by the state's interest in AGDC. You have to have a vehicle, because I really want to see smooth operations between the treating plant in North Slope, the pipeline, and the liquefaction plant. They all have to operate together in unity. If each one becomes a separate profit center competing with each other, you can imagine the problems you'd have. You won't have a smooth, integrated organization. It's always been my belief that that is the best answer, and we've never even contemplated here at DNR of any other structure to do that. So I just want to put that on the record, that if you were hearing rumors or stuff, I don't know where they're coming from. They certainly weren't coming from our intent. The letter that you received from me verifies that, since you folks wanted to see it in writing. But it's the only logical structure for the state to be in. It structures it similar to the rest of the project. And that is one of the reasons, again, that was discussed structurally for buying out TransCanada, was to create this integrated infrastructure piece of it and to have more smooth communications across from that. I see DNR as the customer for AGDC. So, again, our ability to work with them to assure the customer is happy is really important. As the customer, I'm going to be a tough customer. I'm going to want low tariffs. I'm going to want inexpensive transportation, because that increases wellhead value, which means more money goes to the general permanent fund. So anyway, as a pipeline company, you know, they want to be viable. But the pipeline companies aren't always the lowest guys that want the lowest tariff structure. In fact, they prefer, look, the history of TAPS. They clearly did not prefer it. I want expansion in that pipeline, because we manage a lot of other gas on the North Slope as well. We also want opportunities for our partners in Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and in Federal and Doyon to have opportunities to put their gas in the system. So we're very insistent on expansion, and we're very get that commercially or with a larger pipe. That's why DNR is so interested. That's why, as AGDC communicates back to the project, it's important to have good communications and for them to recognize their customer really wants these things. So there's a natural tension that's there, but the communications across the needs of the customer to the pipeline has to be crucial. And again, the customer wants it cheap. He wants a high-quality product cheap because it raises his wellhead value, raises the profit, ultimate profitability of the state. The state will not make money on the pipeline or very little money on the pipeline. They'll make their money by selling their gas and getting the highest wellhead return we can for that gas.
I have one more question, members, and then I think this is something that I believe that we all have a concern about. Commissioner, there is concern about the autonomy of the AGDC board and the ability to make their decisions, that they would receive pressure from the administration somehow on how to vote, how to do their process and the work that they do. Other information that I received when I have heard this, so I went to look and find out some other things. So, and I'll give you an example. The Board of Fish is also supposed to be an autonomous entity, absent of political decisions. Yet, it's my understanding that Governor Walker contacted members of the Board of Fish to ask them for a venue change for next year's meetings. This is absolutely unheard of in my mind of boards that are supposed to be completely autonomous of politics, boards that are supposed to not have legislators, members of the administration, putting pressure on them to make their decisions. What assurances can you give us today that AGDC will be completely autonomous in the decisions that they make?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I can't warrantee what administration influences have affected AGDC and what have not. For DNR, it is an awkward situation where being the customer, not having a seat on the board, I get information through formal information requests to AGDC, which then makes requests to the MANCOM, which then the information flows back from the MANCOM to AGDC and gets back to us. That's my communications channel with AGDC. I respect they have an independent board, and I really think it's important that if there are challenges with the board needs to talk to you. The board needs to have that discussion with you and explain how it's working or it's not working. I have no idea if the challenges, and I believe Chairman Burns testified, and I've not even had a conversation with Chairman Burns or the board. I believe Deputy Commissioner Rutherford attended one meeting. I've never been invited to a board meeting. So the bottom line is I can't tell you what's happening within AGDC other than the communications we do at the sponsors meeting or in other meetings where there's a process for AGDC to get project information to our team.
Commissioner, you've already told us that you've been instructed by the Attorney General and Governor's Office not to sign confidentiality agreements. I've talked to producers and other members of this gas negotiating team that are very concerned about the fact that they cannot even enter into some of the confidential agreements they have to do because of confidential information, proprietary information that may be provided by producers or other people who are providing information into this, and it slowed down the process, and it concerns me.
Mr. Chairman, any discussion, again, of confidentiality agreements within AGDC are between the attorneys of AGDC and their client. So with respect to AGDC, the Attorney General may represent, I know there are contract lawyers, he has an assistant AG working with them, but there may be a relationship between Department of Law and AGDC, which DNR is not a party to, nor should we be because we're not their client. So I can't guarantee, I don't even know what the issues are between AGDC and their internal confidentiality agreement to work with the project.
We have Representative Sadler, Gaddis, Munoz, and Wilson in the queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Councilor Sadler.
Boy, a lot of questions have been raised and a few answers have been given clearly, and a lot have been answered with conditions and answers that are frankly difficult to follow. I've worked with you both, and you're straight shooters, and part of what gives me some discomfort with the progress of the discussion is I don't know if I can rely on your answers unless I take very, very careful notes. I've heard very many conditioned answers. I hear a desire for things to happen. I hear that a mechanism is in place for something to happen, but I don't hear a clear yes or no or a clear commitment. So I'm going to have to go back, I regret, and try and pin you down on a couple specific questions that the chairman has asked. So I heard the question, and I'd appreciate the most direct answer possible. Is it the administration's intent to terminate this structure going forward, not to vote yes in the work plan and budget? I just need a clear understanding of the answer.
Representative Sadler, through the chairman, the answer is this administration has every intention to move this project forward. Obviously, we'll do that in the form of the commercial agreements as part of the work plan and budget. And you can never be sure commercial agreements are going to materialize in an agreement that is acceptable to all parties. But it is absolutely the intent of this administration to move this project forward under the SB 138 framework.
And not to terminate this project. Yes. And the question was, is it the administration's intent to terminate the project going forward? Because I do hear words like alternative project, and I'll ask Ms. Pitney a question. So that's a yes, right? I'm sorry, it's a no, you did not intend to terminate.
There is absolutely no intention to terminate this project.
Roger, good. Thank you. If I could, appreciate the good. The question was asked, who will vote the state's interest? And the answer, I think, was AGDC will cast the vote on the work plan and budget on December 4th, and it's going to be Joe Dubler. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sadler, through the chair, to the best of our knowledge, it will be Joe Dubler. Joe Dubler is the current AGDC representative on the AKLNG project management team.
Okay.
Do I know absolutely that he will be their choice once they have an integrated project, all three elements of the project? I do not. But I assume that that's who they will choose. But it will be AGDC voting the management committee decision on behalf of the state, assuming you allow us to terminate TransCanada.
Representative Sadler, to the chair, I might add that DNR read about the subsidiary corporation in the minutes, AGDC minutes. We've not been a part to any discussions about how internally AGDC is going to structure their pipeline organization or the GGP component. My hope from the outside as a customer would be it would be an integrated organization, again, because you want to see that smooth flow of gas through a system that's totally balanced and that is working efficiently in all aspects of the system. I'm not aware of how they actually plan to do it. That was an assumption on my part. And again, but AGDC works to their board, and their structure will be determined by their board, not by me as their customer. Even though I would want to make sure, again, that customer, as a customer, that I'm getting the lowest possible tariff structure and an efficient pipeline that's going to assure me that it's both operational and expandable to take the other gas that DNR manages.
It's those kind of silos that's just surprising to us that you're surprised by the development of some of these potentially very significant developments in the structure of the project.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, again, a separate board structure does that. Again, I report directly to the governor. Our processes in DNR are clearly spelled out within the 138. Our confidentiality standards within DNR are spelled out, long history, our requirement to come back to you and with our finding structure. DNR has a very established public structure in this project, and traditionally with our oil and gas manager, we can't do a long-term royalty oil contract, for example, without coming back to the legislature for approval. You put those checks and balances in there for a reason. Those similar checks and balances are not within the AGDC structure. You designed it differently. You designed it to be a separate corporation with a separate board of directors. So it's very different structures, and so the level of information flow that occurs internally and externally is very different on those two structures.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question was asked earlier of Commissioner Myers about the reference on page one of the supplemental request about preparing DNR, the need for a marketing organization is important to prepare for a successful sale of gas to AKLNG or an alternative project. Commissioner Meyer, you said you did not know of any plans for an alternative project. This is an OMB document. I'd like to ask OMB Director, is there an alternative project being considered in any way, shape, or form? And if so, to what degree?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, no, there is not an alternative project. There is an intent that if this project doesn't succeed, that we still move our gas to market. So, but is there no alternative? We want this one to succeed. We're as far down the road as we can be. We're on the cusp of making things work. But absent that, do we not want to move our gas to market? I don't think that's a good alternative for this state.
And through the Chair, I would agree. And my question is just to what degree you're looking past that potential termination to any alternative. And I hear you saying there is no such consideration.
Correct.
Certainly the intent is there. My desire would be that as well. But okay. Let's see. Help me understand a high-level question, which was also asked. Why is it not premature to be working on marketing at this point? And I'm going to make some comments before I let you answer that. On the first page of the supplemental request explanation, there is a bulleted list of projects, commercial agreements, of marketing plan, lease modification, PILT, et cetera, Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was the schedule envisioned to us as a legislature being here in Juneau during this fall for this kind of special session to look at these negotiated agreements to approve them. I could go through each bullet and ask you what's the process, what's the status of this, but in generally, why are we not there? Why are we here instead?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sadler, we are not there because the parties have not reached agreement, and it's not just between the state of Alaska and the producer parties. It is some of the issues are between the producers themselves. We have not been able to attain agreements on some key issues that once agreed to will open up the negotiations on other issues. It is our intention to have commercial agreements to you by the second quarter of 2016. That is something that can only be attained if all four parties are equally committed to finding middle ground and acceptable arrangements between ourselves.
And I guess for the record, my comfort in proceeding with TransCanada's involvement and from SB 138 days in House Resources was we would have this information available to us in order to make the decision whether to terminate TransCanada's involvement and proceed. The information in this document was going to be what I relied upon to make that decision. So you're asking us, I think the colloquial term is a pig in a poke. You know, we don't know. We're betting on the come. Certainly, I have great faith in your credibility and so forth, but I'd have more comfort if I knew the status of these agreements and what was likely to be the outcome of these processes before I committed the state to the course of pursuing an alternative.
Representative Sadler, through the Chair, we had hoped that we'd have the commercial arrangements completed as well, so we have agreement on that one. Where we disagree, is, in my opinion, is why the commercial agreements are absolutely necessary. At the end of the day, as you saw in the presentation made by Deepa Portaval from Black & Veatch and myself, the issue is primarily a financial analysis as to where you want to wear your risk, where you want to make your payments. We are going to pay TransCanada no matter what. But the choice is, do we pay them up front, pay the costs up front, and then become the complete equity holder in the project as the state, or do we bear the costs as part of the tariff structure? I think we had a pretty exhaustive discussion about that. So I'm not sure what tremendous additional value the commercial agreements provide to the decision on terminating TransCanada's precedent agreement.
Representative Sadler, to the Chair.
Take a brief at ease.
Okay. Representative Sadler, to the Chair, something to think about. TransCanada was here, I know, and testified, correct? And there are multiple reasons for them supporting the buyout. And if you think about it, the way the agreement's structured, any one of the five parties could terminate at any time, all the way up to the FID decision in the project at a certain cost. And we talked about how TransCanada could do it, and the state would have to pay the costs of that, of them pulling out, pretty much regardless of why they pulled out. So simply by buying out their interest, now you're down to four parties, and we know the state wants to move this project forward, and we hope and believe the producers want to move it forward. So you're asked about what can help move this project forward. Well, certainly parties that are fully aligned and interested and commercially advantaged by moving the project forward. I mean, TransCanada is a great company, but they had some serious commercial challenges with if they weren't to operate this project, say, the governance pieces of it. It would be hard for them to stay in it, given their business model. A great company. But the reality is, by buying them out, we've done much more assurance the project moves forward. And also, we move forward in a way where we've shown you the economics of the project to the state, the voting rights to AGDC. Certainly everything to me, if you analyze this, points to advantaging the state and moving the project forward, and that's the reason to buy them out now. The fact that the other framework agreements haven't been done is a challenge of the immensity of those agreements and the lack of alignment and commercial differences between the companies as much as the state piece of it. You think of it this way, the state's not a producer. We have to be a producer, effectively, like a producer, in order for this deal to work. Because, again, we're taking out everything as gas, and we have to assure supply. So those supply assurance agreements become number one. If we can't assure supply, we have no business being in this project. We can never make it work. We're better off staying in an RIV world and hopefully getting equity and having the producers shift on our pipeline. That's the alternative model that you proposed in 138. So for this project to work again, we have to have those fundamental agreements to secure our supply to match our capacity in the project. And without that, the other agreements aren't worth the paper they're written on, because the risk is simply too high for the state. So there's a sequencing to these agreements that are critical.
President Saylor?
Thank you. Appreciate it. And that actually helps illustrate the premise of my question. If I understand the necessity, and I'll stipulate all you said, we've heard many presentations over this week about the benefits and the evaluation. But if that's the case, then convince me why it's not premature, if we don't have all the necessary commercial agreements and the supply, et cetera, to go immediately, or at this point, to marketing. Please tell me why going to marketing and spending money on marketing at this point is not a premature, is not jumping the cycle.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, the team you have to build can't be built overnight. It takes years to build a competent team, first of all. And we know we'll have to have the contracts in place to market at the FID decision. You look at this time frame, that's not many years down the line. Secondly, the state has to negotiating a marketing position with the producers as a part of the RIK process. So we're going to go equity marketing or venture marketing. We need to decide that. And so helping us to decide that, we want the best professionals available in the field to help us guide us into that. So each step of the way, there's an important understanding or decisions the state has to make in marketing, and some of these decisions are negotiated positions with the producers in each step of the way. So those negotiations are part of this whole process of getting the baseline information you wanted to have by December 31st. But it goes beyond that, accelerates after that. So putting the people in now is absolutely critical.
And then to that point more narrowly, so I'm going to come down from my 40,000 feet to the 500 feet kind of thing. So I understand that there's been, I think, $360,000 in the budget available for marketing positions so far, and the request is being made to add another $480,000 to add to that to come up with the $840,000. Has there been recruitment efforts to fill the position at the $360,000 year level, and if so, what were the results?
Reverend Sandler, to the chair, we have not begun recruiting, again, because we don't have the funding for the position. I don't want to do a recruiting without some assurance we have it. If we can get the position, the high qualified person for less, we will do it.
But I heard someone say, I believe, that the $360,000 was already available, but you've not tried to fill it at that level. Is my understanding that?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Representative Sadler, this is Marty Rutherford, Deputy Commissioner, DNR. We have the $360,000 effective July 1. We were in the midst of beginning to get a sense of what we could buy as a marketing lead. I must say, all of us in that have been involved in this project have been shocked at the price tag associated with marketing leads in the industry in the United States and around the world. And so we realized relatively quickly as we began the outreach about the same time the budget became in place that that would not suffice. So this was part of the discussion as to how we were going to deal with this, and, you know, as the discussions evolved around the special session, we knew that this was going to be an opportunity, we hoped this was going to be an opportunity to adequately fund it so we could actually recruit successfully through somebody of that caliber.
And I think I heard that there was not really a recruitment or an open post or anything. It was just Audie Setters and kind of a, we think this isn't going to be enough.
Reverend Sadler, through the chair, again, we went to Human Capital. We went to Black & Veatch and asked them. When I heard the sort of prices that our folks were suggesting, I asked to do a lot more due diligence on this kind of cost because I knew this was going to be an issue, quite honestly. And I said it very clearly to Marty and the team, we have to benchmark this. And so they went back to Human Capital. They looked at the market costs. And, again, I think the Analytica folks really are independent of us. They're your consultants, and they're telling you the same thing. This, we're in the ballpark.
And Representative Sadler, just let me add to that. Black & Veatch did not just rely on their own expertise. They also did outreach to multiple parties to before they provided us their feedback. So it was a relatively broad effort. There is not hard data out there that everybody's. So it was not like picking up some sort of a data book that provides this kind of information. They had to actually go to parties and solicit this information. They didn't always get it, but they got enough to give us the sense of it, and it was consistent enough across our contacts that we reached this indication. And I was very relieved to see Analytica indicate to you in their own analysis that we were relatively consistent with their analysis as well.
I appreciate your indulgence. I've asked a lot of questions. I'll jump back in the queue for later.
You, thank you, Sadler. Representative Gaddis, then Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask a question about four or five questions ago in regards to the confidentiality agreements, and we've certainly beat that to death, but I tell you what, I just cannot help not understanding why we as the state of Alaska would not want to know all the information that we could to make the best decision for the state of Alaska. And I know we beat it to death, and I suspect I'll not hear any different answers than we have. So, you know, I guess I just want to go on record that it concerns me as a citizen of the state of Alaska that we wouldn't do our best to get all of the knowledge that we could. And again, I know that we've done the dance. I mean, we've on both sides asking and getting the information, but I think that you're remiss at not getting all of the information that you could. Now, again, we beat it to death, and I don't intend to continue. I just wanted to make that statement.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis. I think it was a large concern of all of ours. We have Representative Munoz, followed by Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, yesterday from Exxon, Mr. Butt indicated, you know, the importance of alignment, and one of the key issues in that goal is the ability to have protection of intellectual property through confidentiality agreements. And I'm interested in why, or getting your perspective on why the AG, who's involved in the commercial aspects of the project and is also the chief counsel to AGDC, is unwilling to enter into confidentiality agreements as it relates to the project.
Representative Unos, to the chair, you honestly have to ask the AG. Well, none of us are attorneys, but you know, I do know one concern that, again, I've been in a lot of public policy jobs in the federal and state level, and one of the concerns is if the confidentiality binds you from telling the public enough information about the deal, right? We got to come back, and a certain number of information has to be public. If it's overly broad, then there's an extreme trust us. If you can just look at some of the issues on the federal level that percolate up over actions and the inability to be able to explain because of military confidentiality, for example, creates doubts in people's minds. And so on a commercial side, I think we are concerned about having it overly broad, just because can we explain it to you, that people that are not under the confidentiality of the general public. That balanced off with you got to have the best information. I fully respect and agree. I'm a scientist by background training, and I believe in getting all the information, believe me. So we have to find a way to get all the information but still be able to explain to the public with adequate granularity why these decisions are being made. So that, I know that balance is an issue, but I can't really explain it more than that. You'll really have to ask the Attorney General or his designee.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, do we have the Attorney General coming back before us on that question or on other questions as well?
I believe we'll have the Attorney General on Monday, I think.
Okay, great. And then finally, I do want to thank you, too, for providing the clarity in terms of where the TC shares would go if we decide to buy out TransCanada. We received a letter from the commissioner as well as from the governor this morning that clarifies the intent, and I appreciate having the information. Thank you.
I did send him a thank you note for that one. Thank you, Representative Munoz. Representative Wilson, followed by Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm back on page 6, which I seem to be stuck on. Okay, so first of all, where it says allowance for, why is it allowance? Is this amount that you think we're going to have to pay? And also, why would then the 8.8 be in the left column versus the right column? I guess why is it in the left column? Because it's added to the 31.
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, there was 38.4 million anticipated when we made in the summer and in the fall or spring and in the summer when we had the estimate of 108 million. We were assuming roughly 70 million in the TransCanada buyout plus the 38.4 for remaining cash calls for the midstream through the end of the year. And it turned out that the remaining cash calls, had the scope not changed, would have only been 29.6. So that was where we were. That was an estimate we made last spring and last summer. And so the actual now is what it would have been without the scope changes, plus the 31 for the scope changes, plus the 15. So that 8.8 was when we were making our estimate in what we thought it would take to buy out TransCanada and assume the cash calls. We assumed it would be 38.4, the combination of that 29.6 and the 8.4. As we got up to this new estimate on pre-feed, the changes, without the changes, it would have been 29.6, which made our original estimate a little bit off. With the scope changes now, it's the 29 plus the 31 plus the 15.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Wilson.
So these are actual amounts. These are not projected amounts that we owe, but this is actual amounts that we owe that would make us then current with this agreement for the end of this year.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is correct.
And another follow-up?
Follow-up, go ahead.
So yesterday we learned that then if we go to the meeting on December 4th, we will be required for an additional $60 million. So for the project at this point, so you're asking from us, without talking about the agencies, $204 million.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the 29.6 plus the 31 is the $60 million that will be required.
So the total is 144. We don't add that 60 in there.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. 144 is the total amount that would take us, that would, for our full participation on midstream and downstream through the pre-feed cash calls.
Okay. And then I have another question.
New question, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. So I am, this is not my subcommittee, DNR is not. And so I'm following just along with, I don't know whether or not you don't have the money for the ask that you have for now that's, you know, just under $2 million. It sounds like to me more that it may be in a different part of your budget and you can't take that part of your budget and fill it in over here on this area because you're designating specifically that it's coming out of oil and gas and not maybe out of permitting. So I'm not too sure this is a question for DNR or a question to whomever has this subcommittee, but I would be very interested to know whether or not the money could be adjusted within that budget to be able to make sure they have enough for this project versus new funding.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, this is Marty Rutherford, Deputy Commissioner for DNR. We do not have the money. The just under $2 million that we are requesting includes only $300,000, which would be backfilled to the actual agency within, and that $300,000, goes directly to the Division of Oil and Gas to backfill two commercial analysts within the Division of Oil and Gas. Everything else is money that is unavailable. So if, in fact, we do not have this additional $1.8 million, we will not be able to backfill the two commercial analysts, and all of the funding for our commercial contracts, the people who assist us in the commercial negotiations, will not be able to continue forward at the rate that is necessary to get you commercial contracts by April 2016.
Mr. Chair, that's not my question, okay?
I'll try again. Your question, please.
I'm from North Pole. We ask differently. So what is your budget for the Department of Natural Resources, your total budget for the Department of Natural Resources?
For the
year that we're asking for this supplemental.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't have that number on the exact top of my head. However, I do know it was reduced by 18% last year. Significant decrease. One of the agencies that got the largest decrease in the 15 to 16 reduction. Oil and Gas received a reduction. They also did not receive the increase associated with the AKLNG project that was requested. So there's tremendous stress on the Department of Natural Resources overall budget, and I can get the total budget that it was in 15, what it is in 16, and why that this is required new money to allow the division to progress on this project.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate that, and I can look up the numbers myself. It is what my point is. I understand that in the Division of Oil and Gas, you may not have these funds. I am not convinced that within the Department of Natural Resources entire budget, and I personally would prefer to hear that from whomever has that budget versus the department, because they made those decisions and why they, you know, where they may think there's other funding that just may need to be shifted versus new funding, because we're going to be going into another year, which we all know, and which is going to be more decreases, not less decreases. So I just want to make the distinction that I do understand you don't have it in this division. Mm-hmm. I am not convinced that you don't have it anywhere. So
that's on that, Representative Wilson, you're exactly right. Last year at the end of session, to work out a compromise to get out of session, there was an unallocated $30 million reduction. I believe the DNR's role part of that was about $480,000. Is there an issue here where we're just trying to backfill the reductions within the departments that the legislature requested?
Representative Newman, Representative Wilson, to the chair. Fundamentally, DNR generates $35 of general fund for every dollar you give us. Cuts that will be made to the organization will have severe consequences on the revenue generation side, or closing a major agriculture, forestry operations. We've looked at this hard. We're ready to present to you. We're excited about presenting to you. The bottom line is, if you look at where the economy starts in the state and where it finishes, it comes from those 160 million acres of state land. And if we're not going to manage those to maximize the economic benefit for our citizens, we can make those choices. But that's where we are. I'm just going to be honest with you. I run a lot of organizations. I've run an organization 8 times bigger than DNR. And I can tell you, I've had internal people look at us and external people look at us. We are really strapped as an organization. For instance, in the last 10 years, DNR has had a budget increase of total of 8% of general fund. Its inflation's been 16%. Look to the agencies that have had the big budget increases when we talk this way, because it's not one size fits all equation. So I would just plead with the committee, when you look at this thing, look at revenue generation and loss of revenue generation by cuts versus just simply you can take it from someplace else.
We're not going to get into budget negotiations right now.
I just have one follow-up. But there was a comment made, and that's why I made these questions, that Deputy Commissioner said that since you were here for special session, you made the request now versus coming back to us in February. So therefore, it gave the indication that if we weren't here today making this decision, most likely we would have seen these asks come back in February. So that's just a comment. I'm not going to start a battle. I think I already did. But I still would like to hear from whomever, and I'm not sure what member has, but whoever you are, if you could kind of look at your budget and answer some of our questions and bring it back to us, I'd appreciate it.
I believe Representative Pruitt has that one, so you can ask him about that one. Representative Edgman, followed by Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. Before I get to my question, I just want to make sure that we have a, you know, a pretty sharp distinction between what really is taking place here. I've heard, with respect to the Deputy Commissioner, I've heard on more than one occasion the statement made that if the legislature approves the TC buyout, when in fact that decision, as we all know, has been made. I mean, we're here approving the money, essentially, is what we're doing. We're not, you know, from a policy point of view, making that decision. I really want that, you know, the record, the transcript that goes forward in the time to make that clear distinction, because the legislature is not making the decision to terminate the TransCanada contract. We're making the decision to approve the funds to do it. That's a very big difference between that.
Commissioner?
Yeah, Representative Edgman to the chair. The decision is mine as DNR commissioner, but I will not make it unless we have funds. And the reasons for that is that it's possible, unlikely but possible, without the buyout, the project will continue because I can negotiate a contract with TransCanada and they may stay. So me terminating it early and not being funded means the project is, the state will not be able to vote positively on the work plan and development because it won't have the funding to do it, and the project will stop. So in order to avoid that, I want to be assured we have the funding because I do not want this project to stop, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that they may stay. I think we heard from them that it is their intention to terminate with the state.
Yeah.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate that, Commissioner. I think that that's certainly a valid point, but TransCanada is exiting. We know that. I mean, to say otherwise and that the decision has yet to be made formally, that's technically correct, but it's also a matter of semantics. We know that they are exiting the stage. They're not going to be there on December 4th to vote in a way that would advance the project. So in my estimation, the legislature will approve the TC buyout provision, and we're now essentially here at the table still discussing organizational chart issues as well as the finer details related to the supplemental budget request. Along those lines, Mr. Co-Chair, I think, in fairness, we have to keep in mind that we have a new administration in place, a governor with deeply held beliefs that, in some respects, very, very, very different, very dramatically with the previous administration. And with a new governor and a new team coming into place, there are alignment issues by virtue of just organizational challenges. I've seen this a few times before, so I have to sort of put it in that context that there are going to be some wrinkles that maybe the Walker administration over time will smooth out. And in terms of assuming this project goes forward in the way that we all want it to go forward, some of those challenges will be met. But that said, in the meantime, as a member of the legislature, you know, I have the right to uphold the Reagan mantra of trust but verify as well. And so my question is, among the many I have, but I'm going to try to keep things limited here. When I look at the governor's press statement from September 18th upon the return from the Japan trip, I think, Deputy Commissioner, you were part of that. The commissioner was not. And then I compare the press release to the organizational chart that I think came from the administration. Why is Audi Setter's referenced in the governor's press release on September 18th as Alaska Gas Team General Manager And then in terms of the conversation we've been having here today, he's the lead marketing guy. And then on the organizational chart, he's listed as Audi Setter's marketing lead. You know, that feeds the blurriness that I continue to observe and who's really in charge. And I'll just close by saying this, that, you know, the presentation we had yesterday from Mr. Butt left no doubt who's in charge in terms of the actual project itself, you know, as we move in from the pre-feed into the feed stages. But I think I also heard to the media yesterday that his counterpart on the state side is not somebody similarly in the middle of the organizational chart, but in fact it's the governor of Alaska. So for us to get the full picture we would need to get the equivalent of the perspective we were provided by Mr. Butt yesterday, we'd have to have the governor of Alaska at the table. And I'm certainly not going to presume to demand that he come before us. But I'm going to leave this special session, Mr. Co-Chairman, still with lingering questions about how, use Analytica's term, the organizational clarity exists, because I don't think I'm going to get the full picture. But we don't have the governor here today. We have members of the Department of Natural Resources and his budget team. So I'll just leave it with a specific question about what's Audi Setter's true role?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, I apologize. This is too close. Audi Setter's was hired by the Department of Natural Resources as a consultant on marketing. He is still under contract to the Department of Natural Resources as a contractor for marketing. We consider him a subject matter expert. There was a period of time in May, June, when the administration chose to have Audi leading the commercial negotiations. That did not continue for any significant length of time. I think, and so he's very much now, again, the marketing contractor for the Department of Natural Resources, but working as part of the teams that were discussed as part of the bottom of that organizational chart. The one thing I can say is those teams are matched by company representatives at approximately the same levels in each company. You do not have any one particular head for BP across all commercial negotiations, nor do you have that for Conoco for ExxonMobil. We have these teams that function for each issue, each agreement, and they will eventually roll up into commercial agreements that are hopefully finalized. Truth be told, those leads within the departments or within the teams, just like over in the companies, the BP teams answer up to Janet Weiss. The Conoco teams answer up to Joe Marushek. The Exxon teams answer up to Jim Flood. The project, Steve Butt, it's a very different animal. They have a management team. The project is different than the commercial negotiations. The project is not part of the commercial negotiations. Our equity holder in the liquefaction and our equity holder is in the form of TransCanada has been part of the commercial negotiations. But Steve Butt is not part of the commercial negotiations. So I would argue that the state of Alaska's executive officer is equal to the Janet Weiss, Joe Marushek, Jim Flood positions, and our teams, which are supported by legal, commercial, subject matter experts, answering up to the head structure at the end of the day, is not dissimilar to the other equity owners in the project.
Hello. You have a question?
Well, I do. I primary question was never answered about why is Audi Setter's listed here as Alaska Gas Steam General Manager on a press release, an org chart, he's the lead marketing guy.
Let me take that, Marty. Representative Edgman to the chair. I mean, the governor has made some changes. He is the chief officer, and when he placed Audi in charge, he replaced Marty, who was serving as our chief negotiator and coordinator of the structure. And as a chief executive, he has that prerogative. The same way, I think he replaced Audi with Rigdon into that role at a later date. So as a chief executive, he's simply exercising his prerogative to change leadership over time, and I think that's what you're seeing happening.
Thank you. And just for some housekeeping, members of the committee have prior obligations, so we'll end today's meeting at 12:30, and I'm going by the clock at the back of the room. Representative Edmund? Rice?
Mr. Co-Chair, I'll just finish up by saying that I guess I have more homework to do because I still have questions about AGDC's true authority and the true role that was envisioned by Senate Bill 138 and really sort of the command structure that's sort of been developed after. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not trying to impugn anybody's motives here or anything like that. But I'm saying that it's still not been demonstrated, at least to me, probably the weakest link on this chain around the table here. And vis-a-vis, I guess we're going to have the Attorney General here in a couple of days. But I see overlapping responsibilities, and I see policy decision being made in different entities. And I don't see the organizational clarity that I think I should see. And maybe it's just because I'm not fully immersed in the whole picture yet.
I think that's been somewhat the overwhelming theme of this committee today, Representative Edgman. We have Representative Guttenberg, Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been around the building a long time, probably some would say too long, but a long time, even before I sat in this chair. I'm not sure I've ever seen an issue generate so much outside conflicting buzz from all different parties, and I'm not quite sure what the motives of every one of them are. Mr. Krishner and ladies, you guys have done a very good job, from what I see, of answering questions and trying to delineate your role in a shifting project. I mean, this project is changing and evolving, just like Mr. Butts illustrated, that there are things in their org charts that are changing also. And I won't get into some of the questions that you've already answered a few times, but under Senate Bill 138, which we passed under a different administration, Mr. Commissioner, you said we went from a passive player to an active player. Now, we did that before you were here. So could you illustrate a little further on how that changed the state's role in this process?
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg, to the chair. It's a very significant change, very significant in that you have traded security for commercial viability, if you would, in terms of the state's role. So my understanding is when the previous administration negotiated and legislature approved 138, it was designed to bring approximately the same as the passive role would be in terms of overall revenue to state, assuming SB 21 structure. At least that's what we've been told by the consultants that worked on it for the previous administration. So in that switching of roles, it did a couple things. It put the state more aligned, less of a sovereign, and more as a commercial party to the agreement. That in changing that role, we went from a passive royalty and tax structure, basically an RV. What we did do, we had the ability to always do RK, but practically in an LNG project, you would not because their gas would be locked up in long-term contracts. So the commercial structure state has had an oil and gas window of work for this project, and that was recognized. And so stability was needed all the way from SGDA, the GA. They all contemplated having to fix some of the structural issues for long-term gas sales down contracts where switching just really couldn't be done and maximizing use of those capacities. But given that, the state has to make direct investment, right? We have those numbers. Those are not numbers the state would normally do. We might do them through credits, but we wouldn't do direct project investment of billions of dollars or finance. We wouldn't go out and take out loans to buy infrastructure, billions of dollars worth of infrastructure we are going to purchase. We wouldn't take project failure risk, and we are in this project. If it fails, our money's lost. It's sunk costs. That is a very big change. Now, in what we receive back, is we receive a project.
right? That's the goal, right? If everything works, then we actually are unlocking the gas that wasn't unlocked by the previous mechanisms. But we are taking a lot more risk. We are taking a lot more of a commercial role. We are surrendering sovereignty in terms of severance tax for a set amount of gas. We are flattening royalty rates on things. We're doing all sorts of things to look like an oil company. But in the end, we're not quite an oil company because I can't get a drill rig and go out and find more gas. I'd love to do that. That's what I used to do in the past. It's a fun job. But the reality is we don't have a state drilling company. I mean, we don't have a state exploration arm. We don't drill our own leases. We are passive. Therefore, we have to fix those things through a complex series of commercial agreements, which are being negotiated. So the upfront cost of changing horses from a passive to an active investor means we have to create out of whole cloth a new commercial structure. And we have to do a huge amount of direct investment. And we have to accept a huge amount of project risk. That's inherent in what was designed here. And you not only did it, but we did it on one of the biggest projects in the world. And we did it with lots of different partners, right? And we did it with a requirement to make commitments now that will last for more than two decades. So we're locking it down, right? Constitutional amendment. All those are really, really big changes, right? So this is a sea change in the way the state has operated. Now, Norway's done some of this. Other countries have done it. You can go to Nigeria and you can find a state oil company. But you can't in Alaska. And you really can't anyplace else in North America that I know of find this model. So we are blazing new territory for this model. It's not bad or good. You made the decision. We are doing it. But that decision is not an easy one, particularly for a state that doesn't have a huge budget surplus. And this is risk capital you're putting in. So we're trying to say that's why we need this commercial expertise. We really need the best people in the world to be doing this because of the scale of this project and because of the inherent risk associated with it. And we want to be successful. But we are changing the paradigm. Does that make sense, Leo?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grisham, it's very somebody that's been tracking the industry on the outside for a long time and our relationship with it over all of the issues. It's something that I scratch my head about. You know, I mean, I think the state should have been more active for a long time, but in other places it should be more passive as well. I mean, and to play both sides of that at different times is very difficult, and around a table like this with all of us, so those discussions become real convoluted. So one more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday, Mr. Butts was asked if you not signing the confidentiality agreements was problematic, and he said it could be. Not that it has been, that it could be. Have you ever not felt that you had the information you need to make a decision, and what would happen if you got to that point?
Representative Gutterberg, to the chair, I have told the governor if I got to that point, I would sign the agreement because I felt it was that important. But it has not gotten to that point. The working relationships with respect to data flow, I'm comfortable with. I'm comfortable because my deputy commissioner has that access. My whole team has that access of information. I can ask them once you have them look at these ideas. Because, again, the concepts we're negotiating, you don't necessarily have all the details to know where the issues are. And then getting the data back from the producers that has the granularity that I need is available. Again, as a key decision maker, my main job is to run a department. Department that has broad interests, has under 60 million acres of land, has forestry, has ag, has oil and gas. This project's really, really important. But there's no way a commissioner should be the lead for this project because you have to have this broad-based thing. So while I need information, I will drill down on specific issues. I rely on the team, and that's why I want the very best team of people and the resources necessary. To think I'm smart enough to be able to manage all those pieces alone would be foolish. You just can't do it at this level. But I know what questions to ask, and the team is very, very responsive. So the information flows very effectively within our team because everyone else is under the confidentiality issues, and we've been able to work to provide the information that I need. So I'm comfortable with the current structure. If I weren't, because of the risks to the state, I would simply sign the agreement.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gutberg. Representative Gere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sometimes I come into this room, I've got strong feelings, and I test whether or not I'm right or wrong with the people at the table. Sometimes, like today, I come in the room and I'm in the middle, I'm at the ping pong net and I'm trying to figure out what the back and forth is and whether there's really as much disagreement as it seems to me. So let me try and understand some of these things, because I need to, and I need to see if there's as much disagreement as it sounds like or there's not. One thing I think I can get off the table, I've heard some concern about AGDC creating a new entity for this AKLNG project. By statute, they have to. By statute, it says specifically in the statute you have to have one entity in AGDC for the in-state line and one entity in AGCGD in that entity for the big line. So, I mean, that's clear in the statute, right? They have to have separate entities for those two different projects. Or if you're not the right person to answer that, then.
Representative Garrett, to the chair, they need to be separated. Yeah. By what sort of corporate structure, I'm not sure. I mean, there's limited liability issues and all sorts of other. I mean, I know we've got some brilliant lawyers in the room, and I'm not one of them. So,
Mr. Chair, I'll leave that. I read the statute. It's pretty clear. You have to have separate entities for the in-state and the big line.
Thank you, Representative Garrett.
And we'll deal with that later.
On that point, on Monday, we're going to have, again, a review of Senate Bill 138. And what are the roles and responsibilities that were set out in 138?
So that's fine.
We wanted to make sure members had clarification on that.
I think in the end we're going to find out that's just an issue that's required by the statute. This confidentiality thing has consumed a lot of the committee's time, and I've got to say I'm a little bit behind some of the other members on it. So let me understand a few things. Commissioner, am I correct that when you feel like, I mean, you haven't signed the overall confidentiality agreement, but when you feel like there's something you need to know, you'll go in and you'll sign a confidentiality agreement for that meeting, and then also the Attorney General said you're allowed to talk to the governor about it even though he hasn't. Is my understanding correct there?
Representative Garrett, the chair, the administration believes and sent a letter to the producers saying that we really had access to all the confidential information as senior executives, similar to that in the corporations. So we're assuming we have full access in the current structure. I have, in a sponsors meeting, because of concerns that I sent an email back, I will keep this information confidential, which I would have done no matter what.
Then through the chair, and then the AGDC part is clear. They've already signed the confidentiality agreement. Okay. Then there's the question about whether any of this confidentiality agreement stuff is slowing down the project. And just the gist of what I've heard, but tell me if I'm wrong, is that everybody feels like we're on schedule. Unfortunately, we don't have a commitment from the three major oil companies to sell their gas in a binding way yet, but that's something that we're working towards. But otherwise, are we on schedule, ahead of schedule, behind schedule? Because that's been a lot of the crux of some of the questions.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, we're behind where we want it to be, but it's largely because some of the framework commercial agreements have not been fully landed yet, and that slows down the rest of the agreements. In some ways, we are in good shape. The engineering, again, some of the project work is on time. The commercial negotiations are lagging, but that lag, again, is sort of a four-way lag. I wouldn't attribute to any single party. But we know we need to get through these next negotiations in time for the ability to do the constitutional amendment. So we have a framework to make it all work, but it's going to be very, very aggressive.
Through the chair. There's the issue of this this high salary for the commercialization expert. We heard from Analytica. They said don't be penny wise and pound foolish on that. Just so, I mean, now that we're sort of acting as a private company, right, we're 25% owner in one of the biggest projects in the world, if we do the in-kind selection, do you know, does Exxon already have a similar person on board or people on board, the other companies, or would we just be acting like them if we hire this person?
Representative Garrett, to the chair. They have whole marketing structures and very sophisticated teams of people. They do this worldwide. They have done it for years. They're, if not the leading, one of the leading top two or three gas marketers in the world. BP is very, very sophisticated in their gas marketing. Conoco started in the 60s out of Cook Inlet. So we're a bit behind, I would say, and we're clearly under capacity, significantly under capacity compared to the companies.
Mr. Chairman, may I add something to that? Representative Gara, through the chair, this is Marty Rutherford, DNR. I think I just wanted to verify what Commissioner Myers had said, in that we are actually meeting with, as Department of Natural Resources, as set out in 138, we have been meeting with each of these companies' marketing teams multiple times, and I do mean marketing teams, extensive teams backed up by many people that don't even come into the room with us. So, yes, we are already sadly behind.
And then just finally, and I don't know the answer to this, but so you haven't signed the overall confidentiality agreement. Sometimes you sign a confidentiality agreement to be in on a particular meeting. In your professional judgment, Commissioner, do you believe that you've missed out on any information by not signing the overall confidentiality agreement that you need to do your job?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, if I did, I would have signed the agreement, and I haven't. So, no, I feel I've gotten the information that I need and continue to get it through a collaborative process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner, excuse me. Will the $10 million request for the attorneys at the Department of Law, that the Department of Law is seeking in negotiating commercial agreements, whose direction do they work under? Do they work under your direction or the Attorney General's direction? So you have requests, legal requests. Do you make those requests?
Representative Newman, to the chair, we have had good discussions with the Attorney General. Obviously, they will work for the Attorney General, but at our request, we've laid out what we need in terms of capacity. He has made some suggestions, and so there's total alignment, I would say, in that decision-making for that. Again, the Attorney General, it's appropriate for the Attorney General to be hiring the attorneys, but they are clearly world-class LNG guys, and to date, they have been critical for us.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add something to that, Marty Rutherford, DNR. The bulk of the work that the Greenberg Traurig Milbank do is at the direction, or is the genesis is at the team level, because basically the work evolves as the negotiations occur. So it's not driven externally; it's driven from the team that is working on particular issues or agreements.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, sir. I feel for you, Commissioner Meyer, because I think what I heard you say regarding confidentiality is that if there's something you don't know about and you think you should know about, then you'll sign a CA in contravention to the desires of the governor and AG. But it's like if you, I sometimes think we're back in Alice in Wonderland and wonder where our slide is from Analytica. We've heard a number of times repeatedly that DNR did not get all the FY16 budget it wanted. Duly noted, duly logged. But there has been a deficit. We've had cuts, and apparently part of that is the unallocated reduction, which was DNR's share. But to go to the question which Representative Wilson asked, this is your request for a supplemental budget for FY16. How much are you going to need for these processes, marketing, the geologist, your half of your salary, Marty, for FY17? Is this just a one-timer? And how much do you think, actually, Pat, you should answer this?
Yeah.
What's this mean for the FY17 budget?
So, through the chair, Representative Sadler, we actually didn't get to the last slide about what it'll cost going forward, and I'm assuming we'll come back and get that later. But we're estimating, just given the discussion you've had here with Commissioner Myers, we're estimating between 25 and 35 million of kind of of capacity. Now that takes into account that DNR had eight million of it, so it might not be all additional. But we're expecting that in order for us to act as an owner, act as one of the producer partners in this, that we're going to have the capacity across Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, and Department of Law to take on the scale of this project. And so we don't have the exact answers for 2017, but in the final schedule, we say 100 million through the feed section would be what we're currently estimating. So that's anywhere from a 3 to 4 year process, and 100 million for our agency support, and roughly 100 million for the AGD support, because we are becoming essentially a producer company to move our gas to market, and so that's out there. So it will be it's a significant investment, and we'll narrow it down by the time we get our FY17 request in.
Representative, the chair, could I add something? Because there's a period where you're constructing something. If you look at the oil pipeline, the huge number of employees were while you're building it, and afterwards then it shrunk down to a much smaller operational staff. If you look at DNR's role in this, the early stages of building up the commercial capacity, getting the marketing agency going, and then it's going to shrink back to a marketing agency. We envision that marketing agency, by the way, not in our division of oil and gas, but a separate organization, probably like a permanent fund board type structure with a separate board, ultimately in the long run. A relatively small operation if we can do the joint venture marketing. So that will be the corpus. The rest of the folks, the consultants and stuff, then will be not consultants with us anymore because we're through that piece. So if you look at the operational piece, it doesn't look – it ramps up because of all the activity to get to that first gas flow piece. And then we're back to our normal oil and gas pieces and then plus marketing.
We're going to have to wrap up for today if we can. If members have further questions, you can always get them to the chair and continue to do that. Commissioners, are you going to be available for questions or have people available for questions if members? And if members would like them again on the record, just get them to the chair and we'll ask them.
Representative Newman, I'll be available and in town at least through Wednesday for questions. And I honestly will get your questions. Deputy Commissioner Rutherford has to go home for a few days now. But I will be here in person.
Well, she gets to feeling better, too. So yeah. Issues in Pat. It's been a long, stressful time, I know, for you guys in all this negotiation. So with that, tomorrow we do have the Alaska Gas Line Development Authority, AGDC, here. And part of that discussion will be the Public Records Act and how it relates to AGDC and their autonomy. I think that's been a concern. So we will continue to go on that.
Mr. Co-Chair,
with that, we will
is that a change in schedule? I thought we were having
no,
David
that's
Teal
the schedule that's been tomorrow. Posted. It's not a change in schedule.
Okay, so I missed it then. Thank you.
And then on Monday, we have the Attorney General and Department of Law on Monday. So with that, thank you, members, for your commitment. We will adjourn for the day.